Let's pray. God, you are a Father that reads our hearts and doesn't put all much stock in our words. You read our hearts. Saddens you when we say, yes, Father, yes, Dad, and don't mean it. You are hurt and angered by our compliance and our willingness to say the right things in order to get out of trouble and get your favor and get you to bless us. But we're just like little kids that are trying to manipulate our parents to be get what we want. And I'm sorry for that. We struggle to submit to your discipline, to your teaching, loving hand, and I'm sorry for that. God, I ask that you would cause us to want and be willing, even want, but certainly be willing to go through the refiner's fire. Because we want to be holy, because we want a right relationship with you. It's kind of like a little kid that needs to mow the lawn and do his chores so he can go hang out with Dad. He's motivated to do it because he wants to go hang out with Dad, because his perspective is going shooting guns or riding motorcycles or doing something, but hanging out with him, Dad, is a good thing and he wants to do. And God causes us to want to be motivated to hang out with you. And we don't get to hang out with you when we're hypocrites, when we don't do what we say we're going to do, when we speak one thing and do another, when our lives are unholy. So God, please, please change our perspective so that we are not religious people who think that by saying the right things and not doing certain things and doing certain others that we are righteous. Cause us to realize there's only one way to be righteous, and that's submitted to you. So give us a better perspective of that in the few minutes that we have to hang out. I ask you to teach us, please. We need you to teach us. We need you to soften our hearts. Our hearts get so hard and our ears get so interpretive of what's said, and it goes in and into our brain in a way that is oftentimes not correct. Stir that synapse up and that connection up, that we would move towards being holy, set apart for you. Thank you, Jesus, for giving us a privilege. We lose sight of the fact that it is a privilege and an honor to be able to serve you. To call you Master is a privilege and an honor. And please cause us to see it that way. Amen. So we're in James. You know this song again. Thanks for singing it again, Levi. I don't know that you knew you were supposed to, but you were supposed to. So, thanks. Yeah. You know, these words, when we sing them, sound so sweet, right? And we all want this to be our life. And we all want to sing it as if this is the expression of our heart. We want to feel good in singing it. But there's a side of it. Are you kidding me? You know, I'm going to read the words again. The refiner's fires. Purify my heart. Let it be as gold and precious silver. Purify my heart and let it be as gold. Pure gold. And that's what we want. And it sounds so pretty when Levi's picking the guitar and his voice even sounds pretty, you know. And his face isn't, but don't look. You know, look. So we sing the song and makes us want to be there, makes us feel good, makes us want to, but refiner's fire, is that really my heart's one desire is to be holy, set apart for you, Lord? I choose, you chose that word correctly, I choose to be holy, set apart for you, my master, ready to do your will. Is that really a heart? Does a heart really call God our master? Is that really our heart's desire? My heart's one desire. Because holiness, again, we talk about this at times, but the enemy's done a good job of making holiness not necessarily an attractive word. You know, seems it's got tremendous religious connotations and, you know, and robes and all kinds of crap that are attached to it that should not be. We should truly long for God to purify our heart. And the truth is that there is no way for hearts to be purified without pain. You know, we want to purify our heart by doing good and getting praise, and isn't that it? We want to think our hearts are purified by acting in such a way that we get the acknowledgement and affirmation and kudos from our peers. We want to think our hearts are purified and we're holy by being good churchmen. So when we walk in, we know how to smile and we know how to speak and we know how to speak good Christianese, and we get affirmed by the people around us and we say, oh yeah, I feel good now. I feel good about holiness. That has nothing to do with becoming holy, man. Becoming holy is about a refiner's fire. It's about pain. And is that really what we want? Cleanse me from my sin. Just like you purify gold and silver in a stinking cauldron that is just boiling and hot, boiling metal, and purify and refine and scrape this stuff off, man. That's intense. And at the time, how do we view going into those things? How do we view going into that intenseness? Do we view it as, no, that's the natural response, is just like we would to that boiling metal of, no. Purify my heart and cleanse me from my sin deep within. Because that's all that matters, is it's deep within, not on the surface. You know, we have such a propensity to make hypocrites out of people who desire to know God, and we just tend to propagate this sick, pathetic level of Christianity. People have a desire to know God, and we say, yeah, come in, start hanging out with us, quit cussing, quit smoking, quit drinking, quit doing these outward things, you know. Maybe take a shower if you need to, you know, doing it, you know, but come in, hang out with us, and pretty soon you feel an identity, and you feel like acceptance, and you feel, and you've just cleansed the outside up and cleaned the outside act up. And, well, we'll tell them about the real, you know, I've heard this said, you know. I mean, I remember back 9 years ago, or whatever, when I was, sorry, it's been a long time, when we started, God said, you better get your butt in gear and start being part of this body. As I remember being said, in Steve was still here, 8 years ago or something, and Martin, and somebody said, you can't talk about sin on a Sunday morning. You can't talk about the wrath of God. You can't talk about the judgment of God. Because then people won't come in. So we lie to them. We say, oh, you want your life to be better? Well, come and join this group, you know. You want to feel good? Well, we'll come in and make you feel good because we'll accept you and we'll sing happy songs. And we'll teach nice little things that you can kind of go, oh, about. But you can smile afterwards and go on and not worry about it and go on about your life and come back next week and feel convicted and then go through the erasers, as Steve used to say, you know, that aren't either side of the door as you walk out, you know, and they kind of leave it there, you know, as you walk by. And we lie to them. And it was said, you know, don't talk about those things because they won't come. But isn't sin, in dealing with sin, what Jesus came for and died for? And do you have any need for a Savior if you don't understand your sin? Well, you can tell them about the seriousness of it later. And you know, the truth is that's the way we present the gospel in this country. Just accept Jesus as your Savior. It's a free gift. Just accept it. And then we'll talk to you about becoming a disciple. We'll talk to you about the seriousness of it. We'll talk to you about dying to yourself. We'll talk to you about laying your life down. We'll talk to you about the refiner's fire, the discipline of a father. And how can people not deep in their soul somehow go, you lied to me? You know, I mean, you lied to me. You told me this was going to be good, man, and this kind of sucks. You know, because refiner's fire is not pretty, is not fun. But the end, what do we want to be? Do we have a longing to be holy so that we're right with God? It's something that really challenged me all week. Is that really my heart's desire? To be holy? Or do I just want my life to be better and you know, want to feel good about life and feel good about people and feel good about myself? And want my job to go well and finances to be good. And that's why I have God. He's there to take care of those things, you know, kind of clean things up and make sure things are okay. And if I need to fall back on him and call out to him, I will. It's about death. It's about dying. That's why the people kept leaving Jesus. They kept saying, wait, we know what it's about. It's about Judaism, man. We've got this giant new temple. It's about keeping the sacrifices. It's about going to the temple on the annual feast and doing it. And it's about doing, Jesus said, no. Unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you have no part in me. And they went. Are you kidding me? There was 5,000 that left. That was all of them. And the disciples even went, we'd leave, but we don't have anywhere else to go, so I guess we got to hang out. Because why? Because Jesus said it's about death. It's about dying. And the result is eternal life. The result is an intimate relationship with God. The result is joy and peace and happiness and contentment and security that surpass understanding, that don't make any sense in the mess of the world we live in. But it's not about being free from all the messes of the world. And we talked last week, and I think it's really important. You know, the first part of James talks about considering our all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Yeah, right. You know? I mean, that would be like considering our all joy when you, for me, when you have time to go exercise or something, you know, really? I'm supposed to be happy about this, you know? There's nothing happy about this. But, you know, what's amazing is even just in the little weak analogy, when I think about a goat and getting to 10, 11, 12,000 feet, I think, okay, I'm good. Let's go up this hill. There's a reason. And it's the same way, because trials are the refiner's fire, or they're a temptation to sin, right? And that's the really important part we look at. Difficult things. God is sovereign. God made us. I mean, one of the profound things he says is that every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth so that we might be, as it were, the first fruits among his creatures. God's desire is for us to be holy, is for us to have an intimate relationship with him, is for us to be purified from the wretched degeneracy of sin in this world, in our lives. And that is when a right relationship with them. In that process, it's just like our kids. We don't quit loving our kids when they're in the process of trying to be obedient, right? We love our kids, right? But what do we want to see in our kids? A heart that's willing. A heart that's willing to go, okay, you know, you were told not to do that and you're going to get a spanking. Then they give us a hug and go, okay, you know, next time I'm going to think about this again. You know, a heart that is broken and contrite and desiring to do. And that's what God looks for in us. You know, he isn't a perfect taskmaster that when we screw up in public, he's going to shun us and reject us, right? Because then we'll quit acting like that. God's desire is for us to be perfected, for us, which is mature, to be complete, to be holy. And that's for our good. It's because he loves us as our Father, and we're his children. Last week, I you need to remember this, because, again, trials and temptations and tests are all the same word. Okay? And they have a skewed, meaning or a bent or a direction based on how they're dealt with, really. And it's why they come up as different words in the Bible. But it's the same word. It's a test. Okay? And the issue is not, is there not going to be tests in our lives? I mean, God is a gracious, wonderful God. He knows when we need a reprieve. You know, I was talking to Becky yesterday, and she said, you know, they were in their church that she goes to, was in the 23rd Psalm. And it says, you know, he leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul, you know, which is, yeah, that's a perfect loving shepherd that knows when you need a reprieve, that knows when you need to be led beside still waters and lay in the cool grass and find the shade by the tree. And he knows that. But that's not life. It's, you know, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, right? That's going to happen too, as people. But he knows when we need a reprieve. He's a perfect father. And we have a reprieve, we should sigh and just praise God, you know, and go, okay, get me ready. Because that's, you know, I know. It's the same reason that I'm confident in the garden. You know, God created Adam and Eve for an intimate relationship with him, to have an intimate, perfect relationship with him, right? Where they would be full and complete and happy and content and run around naked and eat fruit and life was good and have fellowship with God. And there was no immorality. There was no impurity. There was no bad. It was wondrous. And then sin came in. Sin entered the world. They submitted to the enemy and the risk of free will that God gave man and said, because he wanted an intimate relationship, in a sense by choice, right? We choose to follow God because that's what a real relationship. He could have made us robots. He could have made us little things that did exactly his bidding and had really no choice and acting free, like the animals in some ways, you know, that just functioned. It didn't necessarily have, you know, I mean, animals choose to be obedient at times or not to, but didn't have the ability to have an intimate relationship with him. But he didn't choose that. He said, I want an intimate relationship with my creation. There's a side of it when you stand back and look at it. How could you not want a relationship with God, right? I mean, there's a side of it when you put it on paper. I mean, as the perfect father, as the perfect shepherd, as the perfect creator who made everything in order for us to have an intimate relationship with him so that we would be complete in the way that we were created. It all makes sense on paper. Unfortunately, there's this thing called free will, this choice to who are we going to serve on doing it. And Adam chose and Eve chose to serve the enemy of God. And as a result, sin entered in the world for the first time, the corruption of sin. When you chose to not obey God and not be obedient, and not to be intimate with God, and you chose to serve someone else. So what did God say? He said, so Adam, I'm going to curse the ground, right? From now on, I'm going to curse the ground. I mean, it's the time. What do you have to do? Name the animals, pick fruit. Not much. I mean, but you know what? There was no corruption. Now that we had sin and selfishness that came in, the flesh that came in, there was going to be perversion. There was going to be selfishness. There was going to be all the things that those two things bring in to the context. And he said, so fine. I'm going to make you have to work now because otherwise you're going to be a stinking lazy little boy that wants to spend his life in your parents' basement, playing video games and eating ho-hos and being perverse. Because that's the nature of man, is perverse. And he said, so I'm going to curse the ground. Because in the real world, if you do that, you're going to go hungry. Not going to go well. Hopefully there'll be some real men around that put a boot up your ass. Excuse me. Up your bottom, something. Okay? So, God said, I'm going to put this in place in the world so that at least a few will become men. Will go out there and struggle and go, God, help me. Help me provide. Help me take care of my family. Help me do this because I have to do this because I have to go and it doesn't just come easy. When we hit a trial, when we hit a tough time, when we hit testing, which we all do, I would contend pretty much every day, okay? And temptation, which is the same word, again, often associated with sexuality, and understand this. I mean, sexual perversion, in whatever way, we tend to view sexual perversion on a scale, you know? We tend to look at sexual perversion and go, now that's really a pervert here. And me, I'm not a pervert here. And we don't see sexual perversion as anything outside of holiness as God has designed. Sexuality. And all of us on some level have a hard time ridding ourselves of it because our culture is incredibly perverse. Mankind is incredibly perverse. But our culture is incredibly perverse in doing this. So temptations are there. What is it, you know? If it's a temptation to get attention in the grocery store, you know? To get somebody to go, to take that second look, right? What is that? A sexual perversion, okay? Now, you're being awful puritanical here, aren't you? No, I'm just saying it the way it is. That shouldn't be our purpose, to get somebody's attention turned to us in our flesh. Okay? That's sexual perversion. You know, the same thing, you know, wanting to get feedback from the cute little girl at the whatever, you know, doing it. What is sexual perversion? And we're talking about, oh, those are pretty mild. We don't get to scale it, man. Holiness is holiness. Okay? I mean, oh no, you're really only sexual perverse when you get caught watching porn. That's sexual perversion, right? If you don't get caught, it's not even as perverse. I mean, that's the scale of things that is so wicked. If you just think of it in your mind and don't outwardly do it, then that's on the scale above it. Still, it's not as perverse doing it. But that's not what God says. When we are tempted, And go beyond temptation, because temptation is sin, right? And what is temptation to sin? When my wife pushes my buttons and I want to get angry, right? That's temptation to sin. Yeah, I never do that. I do that, you know. In fact, I would say that, you know, today, you know, I struggled this week doing it. You know, you're going to come and teach today. And it says, this you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. I fail on that sometimes. You know? And that's not okay. A trial, a test. The issue is, how do we view a rough spot? How do we view the refiner's fire? Do we see it as a test, which when we respond to it as God has called us to respond in obedience and submission to God, gains perseverance in our lives, gains strength of character, which brings maturity, okay? Completeness, perfection. Does that trial, does that test, does that temptation cause us to move towards maturity in our relationship with God and those around us? Or do we allow it to become a temptation to sin? That rough spot, is it a temptation to sin to get angry, to get resentful, to get bitter, to get our feelings hurt and to respond by that, to respond in a sexual way, perverse, with somebody other than my wife, you know? Or somebody other than your husband. And it doesn't matter that you act out or don't act out on it, whatever. That isn't the issue. Do we allow a trial or a temptation to move towards sin, which leads to death? So God is going to allow that refiner's fire. If God cares about us, I mean, he says pretty clearly in 1 John, after this, he says he disciplines, though. He scourges those he loves. That's what he says. Scourge. That sounds like a really ugly word, right? Because it is, right? Scourging is a scourging, okay? God, the perfect Father, scourges those he loves. And it says, and if you're not scourged, if you're not disciplined on that level, you should be concerned about who your daddy is. Okay? Because God is the perfect dad who will scourge his children because he knows, just like with our own children, that their souls are at stake. Right? Why do you spank your children? Because their souls are at stake. Not because you want them to behave better in the grocery store. It's a nice side benefit, you know, or better in public, or not being such a brat around the house because they're making you crazy. No, because their souls are at stake. And they're submitting their will to the authority over them. The Bible is pretty clear. That's what makes God pleased with the child. Children, obey your parents. But this is pleasing to God. Right? That's what we know. Not about children or parents, get your kids to say a prayer so they'll be safe. Whew, that's good. Now they're safe. Now, at least they're good. Now we'll try to have them grow up to be good Christians. But they're safe now. Show me that in the Bible. There's nothing that it says. It says, parents, teach your children to submit their will to the authority over them because this is what makes them right with God at that point. And that is what will lead them to go, can I trust submitting my will to the authority of God the Father? Because parents led them that way. Does that mean it will inevitably happen? No. But without that, they're in trouble. Most will never get there. It doesn't matter how religious you become. It doesn't matter how devoutly religious you become. If you don't understand and don't go back and understand absolute submission to the will of your Father, you don't understand a relationship with God. And you're not going to have a relationship with God. Period. And most people never get past that. Because most people never translate that. They just, okay, I'm going to be good. How do I deal with my dad? It's not about submitting my will. It's about compliance. If I learn to be compliant, if I learn to be good when he's around, put a smile on my face and be the happy kid and not do anything bad in front of him and not yell at mom when he's around and do these things, then I'll be okay. Submission of my will to my Father? No. Compliance. And if I'm compliant, when we develop and get older, how do we act as people towards God? Well, if I'm compliant, then I'm going to be good, right? If I don't do this and do that, if I quit saying those words and quit doing those things and participate and be a nice guy on Sunday, you know, and show up and be consistent and be regular in my attendance, and if I'm compliant to the dogma of the religious people around me, then I'm good with God, right? Because that's what you're taught. And if we do that to our children and teach them compliance, that's what they will do. To their destruction. Few will get past it. Some will. But it'll be a struggle. Taught correctly as a child to submit their will to their father, they can trust their father, that their father is there, that their father is somebody who will never leave them, who their father is relentless in his pursuit and love for them. And by father, I mean father and mother joined together in doing that. When you give that child that, I don't have to survive. I don't have to take care of myself. My dad does that. I can trust my dad to take care of me. I can trust my dad to meet my needs emotionally, physically, in whatever way necessary. I can trust him to do that. A child grows up doing that. Dads are trustworthy, man. Fathers are trustworthy. Not perfect. No, dads aren't. No human dad is perfect. But God is amazing in the way that he formed the child, the character of a child, in that how much forgiveness they have towards a father, okay? And a mother. Very necessary, otherwise they would hate us. We'd be hated by our children completely because we fail them and we act selfishly and we do things that aren't nice and we strike out at them and we act in anger and we do things. But the purpose is if we as parents stand in obedience to God and submission to God, giving our lives up, serving our children by submitting our will to God and serving our children, we'll teach our children that dads are trustworthy. I don't have to take care of my own needs. I can trust my dad to do that. Without that, you're in deep trouble. The most important thing that I can do today is confess my sin and say, I'm sorry. Here I am trying to teach. Because this is where we are in verse 19. Let me read the chapter, or the rest of the chapter. It says, this you know, my beloved brethren. That's not really, that's a way of saying this, but the way it really means is, know this, my beloved brethren. Let everyone be quick to hear, and slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Therefore, putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness, in humility receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. But prove yourself doers of the word, not merely hearers who delude themselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he has looked at himself and gone away, he has immediately forgotten what kind of person he was. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, who purposely looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, the law that will set us free, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not becoming a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer, this man shall be blessed in what he does. If anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. You know, I just was very convicted this week, because all of you, probably some far more than others, especially the ones I love the most, have been affected by my lack of being slow to anger at times. Those of you who know me and have been around me, God has made me in such a way that I'm pretty quick to hear. Oftentimes hear you before you even open your mouth. But then I fail to be slow to speak, and at times I fail to be slow to anger. And it's been destructive in my children. It's been destructive in my wife. It's been destructive in all of you guys on some level, because on some level you've all probably felt the effects of it, and it's not okay. And I am sorry. I'm sorry to you guys, and I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to be quick to anger. The consequences are huge. You know, all my kids on some level have known that side of me growing up. And, you know, I can't hide in the fact that, well, it's better than it used to be, maybe. Because it might be a little better than it used to be. But it's not good enough. It's not what God has called me to. This is a commandment. This isn't a suggestion. This isn't, you know, we say, well, the Old Testament's commandments, but we're not under the law anymore. Now it's just the New Testament. We're under grace. So everything he says is just suggestions. I don't see it there. You know, this is a commandment by James, the brother of Jesus, inspired by the Spirit of God, to say directly to us, let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Just think of the lack of destruction in our relationships we would have if we were all better at that. It's a commandment. As any other sin, it necessitates us, in order to be set free from that sin, to appropriate the power of Jesus in our lives. We have to agree with God about our sin, what that looks like. We have to agree with Him about that it's not just who we are, how we are, how we act. That's our flesh that is supposed to be dead. Do we call Him Master? Do we agree with God that that's a wretched thing that puts us in disobedience to God and is used by the enemy to destroy? And am I willing to repent and turn away? You know, I would say yes, I am. And you're probably, those who know me best are going to go, oh yeah, we'll see this. You know, we'll see where if that button's still there or that fuse is still there. Right? I mean, the enemy was able to, in especially in the primary foundation of our marriage, you know, both of us were not living in submission to the Spirit of God for the first 15 plus years. To the demise and devastation of children and whatever. But in that process, the enemy was pretty hard at work to put buttons in. I mean, all of you in relationships understand that are triggers to the flesh. Not okay. Absolutely not okay and need to be eradicated. I mean, it happens before I ever realize it. That's no excuse. That just shows the wretchedness of my soul. And I am committed. And I would ask you guys to be committed to helping me struggle. It's no different than, any other, acceptably, but any other addiction or any other aspect of our character that we have allowed the enemy to form and shape that causes us to act out in the flesh. And my desire should be to be holy, to be as gold and precious silver. And that means not allowing my flesh that caused me to act out in anger. I react in anger. So again, I apologize. That doesn't mean a whole lot and doesn't have a lot of power, but I would ask that you guys take that seriously as I give you the charge, responsibility, and right to say, You know, you don't get to act out that way. So, I think all of us, in your relationships, what would your guys' relationship look like if you were quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger? Maybe better, right? You know, all of ours would. What would yours look like, right? You know, all of ours. All marriages would look better and wouldn't be on the road to destruction or be as destructive as they were if this was true in our lives. That, you don't get to be selfish and be silent and do the silent treatment. You know, that's not an acceptable way to be either. Oh, see, I'm righteous. I mean, I can't stand on the fact that I'm quick to hear. I mean, God, I would say curse sometimes, but bless me with discernment that reads hearts, man. That's not good enough. You know, that's not an excuse. Well, on this part, I do really good. So, okay, don't I get a little slack on the other two, right? No. No, I cannot act out in my flesh on any of those aspects in what we and how we act. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Is anger wrong? Not necessarily. If anger was wrong, God wouldn't get angry. And you know what? God gets angry. God gets wrathfully angry. And if we don't believe that, we have a very wrong view of Him. And a very dim view. And it's part of the reason we don't fear God. Right? Because we've been taught God doesn't get angry. No, He's Santa Claus. Right? He just always says, oh, it's okay. Oh, I understand. Oh, I understand. It's just your flesh. I understand. You can't help it. I understand. That's just the way you're made. I hope we understand. We said this earlier. Let no one say in verse 13 when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and He Himself does not tempt anyone. When we say that's just the way I am, and we expect people to accept it, we're saying that God made me sinful, and that's an excuse. No. God did not make you sinful. God created you for perfection and holiness and righteousness. Sin in the world caused you to be that way and formed your character and shaped your character. And all the ways that the enemy purposely worked to form that character and make you that way. The way we respond in our flesh, the way that we're short-tempered, or the way that we're, or the way that we can stoically act in apathy towards someone whose heart is hurting desperately, right? I mean, Gene's dad was a product of that. You know, he could very easily be silent and listen to his wife go stark raving stupid and go, I didn't do it. I didn't cause it. I guess I'll just sit here and take it like a man. You selfish, self-righteous. He's dead. I can speak that way, and it's okay. He was. And he left a wife that's just tragically ruined at 85 years old. Just tragically ruined because he didn't go, how do I love my wife? What is loving towards me? Not self-defense, not self-protection, not standing in my self-righteousness, not silent, and therefore I didn't do anything wrong. I was just quiet. That's not right either. That doesn't mean you're being obedient, slow to speak and slow to anger. You know? That's not something we're just talking about. The issue you're talking about is not acting out in our flesh. It's not saying that's the way I am and not just responding with a fleshly, selfish attitude. Or do we respond in a way that has a higher regard for others more than ourselves? Because that's what's important. The anger of man, there's a lot of verses in the Bible that says, be angry, but do not sin. Right? You know what the truth is? If you're not angry about some things, you better wake up. Because there's some things to be angry about. Okay? You should be angry about the fact that millions of babies are being murdered. You should be angry about that. You should be angry about the fact that of fathers who are not fathering their you see a little girl running around on the street, whatever little girl means, whatever age that means, trying to get attention with the way she dresses and the way she acts and the projection she's putting off. You should be very angry at her father. Because he failed her. Okay? There's things to be angry about. But it says be angry and do not sin. We should be angry about the enemy's effects on people's lives with sin, about the destruction in people's lives. We should be angry about that. We should be angry about divorce. We should be angry about abuse. We should be angry about a lot of things. But it says be angry But do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And do not be angry in your flesh. We don't get the right to respond in our flesh, right? That's not what God calls us to. He calls us to be dead to ourselves. That doesn't mean that we're unfeeling people. It means that we're people submitted to our master. Putting aside, verse 21 says, putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness. In humility, receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. That's the refiner's fire. Right? Putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness. Is that really the intent and purpose of our lives? I mean, it's a challenge to me. What does that look like? I mean, I spent too many of my years of my life. Yeah, I always had a desire since a little boy to have a relationship with God. That was the most, I would say, in the back of my head, my greatest desire. Obviously, it wasn't because my other desires overshadowed that at times. But it was always a longing I had to have an intimate relationship with God. But being obedient to the enemy and living the way that I did caused a lot of filthiness. You know, the word filthiness is moral corruption. The word actually is a word there's different words for filthiness. This is one that talks about dirt and being soiled, and it talks about moral defilement is what it's talking about. Moral defilement, where we accept things, which we do in our culture. We accept behavior that's pretty unbelievable. Is being fine and natural and normal and, you know, doesn't matter whether it's in the music we listen to. I mean, the truth is most music should offend us. We should not find pleasure in it. Most music that talks about immorality, if you can't be with one you love the one you're with, or it's a peaceful, easy feeling, or, you know, name it, you know. And our generation happened to be a lot more romantic than your guys' generation. You guys listen to some techno crap. I don't know what there is about that that's romantic. But nothing. And it doesn't mean it's pure either. So you just can't understand the words. So the same thing with rock and roll in our day. You know, it's one of the things I hated about it. I mean, hard rock wasn't a matter that, I mean, you just couldn't understand the words. And that was really disturbing to me because you've got this incredibly powerful music that's singing incredibly ugly things that you don't even understand what it's saying, but it's going into your brain because our brain's a pretty amazing filter in doing it. So, I mean, it's an amazing thing when you, in all of us, especially us old people, I mean, we can hear the first three notes of a song, and I don't know what kind of music move you, you know, but, you know, you can hear the first three notes and it actually gives you a physical rush, right? Call it deja vu or something, you know, right? It gives you this sense of, oh, I like that. Listen to the words. You know? I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight. I don't know why I'm thinking about the Eagles, but there's a lot of songs that are just absolutely wrong. And most of those songs, when we were living in the flesh, not in obedience to God at that time, when we were living in the flesh, had a powerful impact on our souls. And we respond positive to wickedness. And that is exactly what he's talking about here. Putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness. Right? It's eradicating those things from our lives. Most of us, if we searched our souls, would have good feelings about sin somewhere in our lives. Bad deal. That is a malignant corruption. That's what the word is. Wickedness. It's malignant. Right? It's something that grows and festers and still alive and will cause you to remain sick. Are we willing to eradicate those things from our life? We should not respond with good feelings towards sin. What does that mean? Giving it up. That means confessing it to God, agreeing with God about it. We can't give that up. Those are good memories. I have great memories about that boyfriend. I have positive memories about having sex with somebody before I was married as a teenager that were wonderful times. No, they weren't. That was wickedness and moral degeneracy that has hurt your life. And until you eradicate it from your life, will continue to hurt your life. Because it's rebellion. To think good about sin, to have good feelings when a song comes on about something that is immoral and sin, about something that disagrees with God's view on it, you know what that is? That's called rebellion. And it's that rebellion that will keep you from having a right relationship with God, because it's the state of your soul. It's a deep state of your soul. That's really it. You feel good about it. You have good feelings about something that completely goes against God. You know, I'm a diehard romantic. You know, when I began to have a relationship and be wanting to have a right relationship with God, I realized that eradication of those, all those good memories of whatever might be, I had to give those up. I had to see him as God saw him. That was not a good thing. That was not a wonderful thing. That was rebellious. That was wicked. That was morally degenerate. That was moral filth in God's eyes. And for me to think well of it is to hold on to things that I shouldn't. Now you think, gosh, you know, that's kind of, you're kind of extreme here and going kind of far beyond. I got to give up. That's called giving up your life. Whoever wishes to gain his life will lose it. Right? And are we willing to lose our attachment to sin? Are we willing to lose those things that we hold on tight? You know, I don't know why we have the survival instincts that we do that cause us to respond, that our flesh responds to. And, you know, whether it's attack, whether it's respond in anger, whether it's, you know, how do we defend ourselves? How do we protect ourselves? I don't know. Those things have to be gotten rid of. Prove yourselves. Here's the issue, really. Because all of us would say, yeah, that's immoral, right? I'm confident everyone in this room, if we talked about sexual immorality, we talked about, call it fornication, whatever you call it about. We talked about sex outside of marriage, okay? All of us in this room would say, yeah, God says that's wrong. I'm confident that's true. You wouldn't be sitting here, right? And yet we entertain good feelings about it. That's being a hearer of the word and not a doer. Prove yourselves to be doers of the word, not merely hearers who delude themselves. Because I'm not engaging in sex outside of marriage at this point. I'm good, right? I'm good with God. We're good, right? Holding on to positive feelings about sexual immorality is evil. God commands us not, you know, that Jesus was pretty clear about it, right, in the Sermon on the Mount. Here he is starting off the ministry. You got all these people coming up and going, all right, how does this work, man? Because, like, I'm not sure who you are, and we've got this temple now. Man, things are going pretty good, man. You should see it. It's rocking, man. I mean, we got, you know, there's a million people show up in Jerusalem. We do the sacrifices, man. We, you know, there's blood going everywhere. We've got a whole priesthood set up again now, man. Things are rocking, man. We have the big church, right? We're doing good on this deal. And Jesus said, okay, I'm going to tell you what it's like, man. It ain't a matter of doing it on the outside. If you think sexually about another woman besides your wife, you've committed adultery. Equal with, in severity of consequence. He wasn't kidding. Oh, no, no. The church we go to says that's not the issue. Just don't do it. Everybody's going to think you can't help it. The church I go to says it's fine to think that. You know, try not to think sexually about the people in church, you know, because that's not really cool, you know, doing it. And try not to act that way, but. It's really not the big deal. As long as you're not doing it, you're good, man. It's good. You're trying. And that's what it is, right? It's about us being triers, right? We're all just triers, kind of like steers or something, you know? We kind of can't quite get it done, but we're all just triers, right? No, God doesn't say anything about trying. He says, be doers of the word and not merely hearers who delude themselves. For if one is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks in his natural face in the mirror, for once he has looked at himself and gone away, he's immediately forgotten what kind of person he was, doesn't see himself anymore. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, willing at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, looks to see, God, what do you want from me? Not what can I get away with, not what does grace cover, okay? I mean, that's what we want, is what can we get away with under grace, right? How much can I do? You know, where can I go? How much sin can I? Well, let's not call it sin. We'll call it we're under grace, and God understands that, and God accepts that, and God's okay with that. That's not what it says. It says we look intently at the perfect law. The perfect law? Wait, I thought we were under New Testament. The perfect law. The law of liberty, the law that will set us free. God gave us those things and put the law in the Old Testament in place to set us free, not to hold us in bondage, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer. This man will be blessed in what he does. We want the blessing, God's blessing in our life, eradicate the filth from our souls. We want the blessing of God in our lives. We want the power of God in our lives. Eradicate the filth from our souls. Be willing to eradicate the filth from our, not just change in the outside. Again, the people in Jesus' day, what did Jesus come down on them for? Because he's talking about hypocrisy here. Not just a faithful hearer, not just a hearer, but a doer. What was the deal in Jesus' day? He called the religious people hypocrites, right? Hypocrites. Because he said, you care more where you get your validation from is from the people around you. Why do we like going to great big churches? Well, probably they're guys are better teachers and more charismatic and cuter and better to look at, and the music's better. But other than that, okay? Why do we do that? Because we love being in a big crowd where everybody's going, yeah, we're part of this. It's just human nature, man. Yeah, we're part of a good movement. We're part of a big movement. We're doing good, and we're accepted in this part. And we're accepted. That must mean it's right. And the more people that accept it, the more people must mean it's right. Hanging out with a few guys, and you kind of look around and go, well, you're kind of a weirdo, so you guys accepting it, I don't know if I really find that important or not, you know, what you think, because you're not really that, you know. But we go to a big group where, it's sad to me, you know, and I've watched it in our day. It's a pretty amazing thing. It happens in churches. It happened in churches when we were kids with the church people, not necessarily us kids, with a pounding organ and a pounding piano going on and a big choir up front singing, man. And there was this, you know, and everybody's going, oh, yeah, man, I love Jesus. You know, you didn't say that quite then because you were talking like this, you know, more, you know. But, oh, I love Jesus. I feel so good about my relationship with God. I'm here, man, and there's power, and it feels good about this. All those kids are going, the organ sucks, man. I don't like this, you know, doing it. And I'm tired of that tenor singing, you know, doing it. The barbershop quartet, you know, getting up there and doing its thing, you know, or something. And, you know, it was... So what'd they do? Look around and go, did you see what happened at Woodstock? I mean, holy cow. The people were, tens of thousands of people were moved to do crazy things, anything, you know, doing, I mean, the power of the rock band was phenomenal in stirring people. Been a concert, man? You got this whole concert, 100,000 people are, we're in, man. We're in. You know, we're part of this. I identify with this. I mean, same thing. Hit a couple strums on the guitar, and the whole place goes, "Way!" You know, we're in. And they go, let's do that at church. Get them in, man. Let's do the rock concert thing. Now everybody's, we're in. Way! Love Jesus. Well, you change the words. Is it necessarily true? Or are you getting your praise in your validation, in your substantiation about your relationship with God by this group of people that you're with? Or do you get it from God by being obedient, by being an effectual doer, intently looking at the law of God? And what does God say? And am I obedient to it from my heart? It don't matter how much you jump up and down, you're excited about it. That doesn't make you right with God, or because I feel better about my relationship with God. If you're living in sin, you feel good about your relationship with God, you should be scared. Because you don't serve the living God. Because the true and living God looks at the heart. What's happening in the confines, in the darkness of your own room, when you're alone. And that's what he cares about. How does the heart act? If anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue, he deceives his own heart. That man's religion is worthless. Wow. And again, the personal conviction, I don't sit here from a high point going, you guys need to get a hold of your tongues. Right? Instead of going, I need to get a hold of my tongue. I need to have a bridle means a constraint, a restriction, a control over. Put a bridle on a horse, you control. Put a bit in his mouth, right? You control the whole horse by doing it. Boom. Maybe just with your fingers, right? You don't even need to yank on his bit if he's trained well. Touch his neck with the rein, he goes, okay, I'm going. Yeah, I'm going there. You don't need to pull on anything, man. We're all good because this bridle's in my mouth, right? That's how we should look. That's how my tongue should be. And the powerful thing about it, he says, if one thinks himself to be religious. Now, that's difficult because many of you probably heard me say, I hate religion. Okay? Because I hate what religion has done to people. I think Karl Marx was absolutely right. He said religion is the opiate of the masses. Religion quells the longing for God and people by making them feel they are right with God by following the dogma of a group of people. And they quit searching for God because they've got the praise and adoration and acceptance of a group of people. That's what I consider to be religion. True religion is not a wrong thing. That means a worship of the God that we serve. A lifestyle of worship of the God we serve. And true religion is right. It's just that there's not very much of it. There's a lot of false religion. In America. In the Christian church. Quote, Christian church. There's a lot of false religion. He says, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Now, you know, there's all kinds of different personalities, and this isn't about personalities, you know. My wife's pretty good at holding her tongue. Doesn't necessarily mean that she has her tongue bridled. I'm not very good at holding my tongue. Obviously, I don't have my tongue bridled. You know, there's a difference in responses. I've often used the example, and most of you have probably heard it, you know, but the fleshly distinction between my wife and I, both of us are pretty extreme survivors. If any of you haven't noticed, my wife's kind of BA, you know, like really BA, like to a negative side. Like if she was a guy, she'd probably kick my butt, you know, doing it, but fortunately she's a little girl, doesn't? So. She's tough. She's so close. She's as tough as any human I know. But her survival instinct, her flesh, okay, would produce when the grizzly bear comes and the grizzly bear attacks, okay? She's BA enough. She could lay there and not move a muscle in her body and have that grizzly bear chew on her. Now, some would say that would be the smart thing to do, right? Play dead. You'll go away and leave you alone, right? She could do it. Not me. That is not my MO, okay? I would kick and scream and try to gouge its eyes out and I might die in the process. So might she, by the way. You know, we say it's there. How many of those who played dead and were found dead got to tell them, oh, it worked, right? Don't quite get those stories, right, on doing it. So maybe it worked, maybe it doesn't, but that's the distinction. My immediate response is fight. It's not flight. That's the way God made me. Not necessarily wrong. God made me that way. The issue is, do I have a bridle on it? Am I responding in my flesh? Same thing with her. You know, God, it's not fight, but it's protection. Do it. She doesn't get to respond in the flesh any more correctly, any more rightly than I do on doing it, right? A bridle on her tongue is probably, come on, let's go. Speak. Say something. Move. Turn your head. Turn this way. Turn that way. Right? It doesn't mean that being quiet is pure and holy, you know? She should care about me and love me. She doesn't need to give the silent treatment. Is rarely, if ever, godly, right? Not responding. I mean, it seems like I see it so often in marriages that are kind of a wreck, and, you know, it's not all characteristic, but so often the guy's more than capable of sitting there and just, you know, or the wife's capable of just listening to him the whole time in her heart, having hatred and anger and resentment towards that person. That's not loving. The bridle in your mouth would be controlling your tongue. You need to say, you know, I love you and I care about you. This is the right thing. This is the wrong thing. This is what it looks like. Okay? Responding in the flesh. Two people responding in the flesh is a recipe for disaster. Never will it. The anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. It doesn't put you in the right place. Having that control. And honestly, I spent all week trying to figure, what does that look like? How do you get there? I mean, I wish there was just a bridle you'd go put on your face, right? Walk around like this or something. Whoa. Okay. I haven't seen that bridle though. I'm not sure what it looks like. How do you get there? How do you bridle your tongue so that you don't, you know, respond? You respond in obedience and submission rather than from your flesh, from your attitude and from your emotions. It's pretty much a guarantee. Emotions aren't a bad thing. Emotions are a good thing. But responding for emotions is usually very dangerous. Okay? Me, I know that. You want to see the worst in me? Hurt my feelings. I know, that's a girl thing. Shouldn't be that way. Anybody who knows me knows that's true, right? Not acceptable, not okay. You're going to see me turn into a full-on, raging, selfish, fleshly idiot? Stomp on my feelings. My response is attack. You know, I'm doing it. It's not good, nothing right about it. I have no right to respond in the flesh. Okay? I have no right to respond from hurt. I'm supposed to be a dead man walking. I'm supposed to be under control with a bridle on my tongue. And if I'm not, all my talk about worshiping God and serving God is useless, it says. That's a pretty scary thing. That's a very challenging thing to me. Need to go? You got enough of me, huh, Mallory? See you, girl. This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. I would contend that we need to be very careful in something like that to not make this into our dogma, okay? Okay? Because it would be very easy to do that, right? Oh, see, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing. I'm not going out hanging in the bar, and I go and visit orphans and widows. So, that's not what it's talking about. That's an example of, this is a practical reality of regarding others as more important than yourself. Okay? Keeping ourselves unstained from the world is, I mean, it's I would contend that's something that we have a responsibility as men, leading our families and as women, and to come alongside our wives and help our wives. What does that look like? How do we erase the stains of this world and be holy people in the midst of this society? We have this propensity to think, well, we don't want to stand too far about because then they'll look at us and go, you're a weirdo, man. I don't want to be like you. No, we want them to think, oh, I want to be like you. I'm good with that. So, you know, oh yeah, I'm good with that. You can have a girlfriend, a boyfriend, live with your boyfriend and still go to church. And, oh, I want to go to that church. That's good. You know, right? Because now I don't have to, there aren't any rules. You guys don't have rules and dogma. You're not judgmental. Nobody's judging each other. You know, you're just all living your life doing it. What does it look like for us to be unstained by the world? Because the truth is, we're supposed to be. You know, the comment that is often made, the only difference between me and the people out in the street is I'm forgiven, right? Well, no, you're not. No, you're not, because you're not repentant of your sin. No, you're not. If there's no distinction between you and the world, there's something wrong. There is something wrong. If you don't look different, if you are not salt and light in this world, you're worthless, it says. We are to be different. What we are not to be, self-righteous religious people who think they're better than others, who stand above, who condemn those, rather than have compassion and grace and mercy towards those who do not have the Spirit of God to set them free from the power of sin and are held captive in bondage by it. We should have compassion and grace and mercy and a soft heart, not judgmental. God is very clear. We don't judge the world. They're pagans that are held captive by the enemy. We should see them as victims that we should love and have compassion towards and care about. But we should be different. Unstained by the world. What does that mean? Unstained by the world. I tell you what. Having fond affection, getting the adrenaline rush when we hear three licks of, you know, whatever it may be, a Beatles song or a, you know, you have to excuse me. I don't know what would inspire you guys, because those things wouldn't inspire you guys. You know, you guys, country songs really are really what moved me or something doing it. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, man. I love country music, but man, there's a lot of stuff I can't listen to. And, you know, country music's so crap. Well, shut up. You know, the difference is you can understand the words, you know, that's the only difference. You know, it's not more corrupt music and more degenerate music. Oh, they're just singing about, you know, your pickup and, you know, Boone's Farm Wine or something, you know, doing it. But no, it is not more corrupt. You can just understand the words and they're clear doing it. Bottom line is, though, to be moved by a song that is immoral is wrong. And to allow myself to be moved by a song that is immoral is wrong. And to allow myself to feel good and get good feelings and sing along to a song that is immoral is wrong. That is stained by the world. That is not true religion. That is not right religion. And visiting orphans and widows. And that's a pretty profound thing. You know, we're a pretty broken world right now. You know, what is an orphan? An orphan's a fatherless child. Huh? I mean, if a child without a cohesive family that's there. Do we love on those people? Do we care about those people? Because those people are broken as a result of it. Divorce breaks people. Just the reality of it. Can't do anything about it. Just the way it is. What do we do about that? And widows, you know, what does that look like? I mean, we live in a world full of broken lives, divorced lives. It doesn't matter what's said about it. They're hurting people that we need to love on, that we need to care about. I mean, there ain't no lack of orphans and widows right now. We're gonna love on people, and we're gonna keep ourselves and purify ourselves from the stains of this world. Is that really what it is? Are we really Do we want to just sing cute songs about the refiner's fire? Oh, yeah, I'm good now. I feel good now. I feel better. I feel pure when we're doing it. You know? Because that was so pretty. I felt pretty. I felt good. Are we going to be willing to engage in the process of purification? Are we going to be... Because God, let me tell you what. God is a loving Father. We'll put that process in front of your face. Okay? He will give you opportunity to face trials and temptations and tests and respond correctly. Because he wants us to become mature. Not because he wants to beat us up. Not because he's uncompassionate or he's insensitive or he isn't paying attention and just letting things happen. Nothing just happens in this world. We would all say God is sovereign, right? We would say that with words here. Are we just hearers or are we doers? Because being a doer about God being sovereign is God's in control. This isn't out of his control. God wasn't sleeping when this started and happened. Right? God's in process here, is very concerned and cares about it. How do I respond? Do I respond as a doer, based on the character and nature of God? Or do I just a hearer? Say good things, say lofty things about God. Do I say he's omniscient? He's all loving. You know? He's all powerful. He's everywhere. He knows everything. Do I say those things? We all say those things. Is that how we live our lives? Or are we just a hearer and not a doer? And I think that James is pretty, you know, an uncontrolled mouth, an uncontrolled tongue, an uncontrolled temper is a sign of wrong character. Being stained by this world and being shaped by this character. And again, for that I apologize. You know, and I want to be holy. I want to be different than that. I don't want to have an unbridled tongue. You know, I've always said, you know, I don't when it comes to men, it doesn't mean all that much to me to hear about your great relationship with God. Just let me go hang out with your wife and kids for a while, okay? Just shut up and let me go hang out with them and I'll see what's really real. It's true for me too. You know, what does my wife say? You know? And that is where the rubber meets the road, and it's real or it's not real. We all have been pretty good about learning how to do acceptable public behavior, right? Because otherwise you don't get all that far in life, right? The world will beat us down pretty quick. But then when it comes to the confines of our home, we put a different level of restraint, you know? Do we act one way at work and another way at home? That would be called a hypocrite. Let's pray. God, I thank you that you know the exact temperature to extract the impurities from the gold and the silver that you created. As you said, you created, your word spoke, your perfect word spoke, created us in truth for a perfect relationship with you. I don't necessarily suppose that is going to happen very often while we're still here. It appears there was a few, you know, maybe a Melchizedek who all of a sudden you transported into your presence. I don't know what his whole life looked like. Maybe it truly was holy. But ours are called to be holy, and we're called to eradicate. Eradicate the filth of this world and the wickedness of this world. and the stains of this world from our lives because we care about having the right relationship with you, and we don't have it while we still hold on to that. So God, please give us a longing. That's what it means. And then it affects all of our relationship to think that that corrupt heart is there, comes out in my anger, comes out in our words, comes out in our hearing. God, please cause us to want to live in truth, to want to live by the power of the cross, which is real and practical and experiential, or it's not. That we can be holy, set apart for you, not as self-righteous religious people, but as servants of the Most High God, as humble servants of the Most High God, where we're serving people, where we're not setting ourselves in a position and wanting to be up front and doing good things to you, but we're serving other people, loving on other people, and keeping ourselves unstained from the world. Because we don't love this world, it's not our home. We're just passing through. Thank you. Thank you for your grace, which is you not striking us dead when we deserve it. Not overlooking our sin, but not striking us dead. Instead, striking Jesus dead in our place. Cause us to fear you. Cause us to love you. I thank you for the opportunity and privilege of knowing you. Amen.